Peter Yim. Hello?
Peter?
Yes. Am I back at the conference with everybody?
Yes, I think so.
Fantastic. I apologize, but looks like we are back in business, and this session is being recorded. This is Thursday, November the 18th at the Ontolog Forum, and we have Dr. Christopher Welty from IBM with us today, and he is going to give a talk entitled An Overview of OntoClean. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Dr. Welty is from the IBM Watson Research Center, and he is going to present the overview on OntoClean with us. So, but before we do that, let's go around and see who is with us. And let's go down the list as they are captured on the attendees list. Pat, would you start?
Hi, Pat Cassidy. I'm working at MITRE now. I've been involved with the upper ontology projects such as IEEE and the X3T2 before that.
I'm Peter Yim. I'm one of the co-conveners of the Ontolog Forum along with Kurt Conrad and Leo Oberst. And I'm your host today. Patsy?
Hi, I'm Patsy Ramos. I'm the project manager for the Enterprise Collaborative Environment with IRS, working closely with Claude Matthews, who is our ontologist.
Welcome, Patsy. Nancy?
I'm Nancy Faget. I'm a librarian at the Corps of Engineers, and I decided that I had to follow Peter, Pat, and Adam today throughout all of our conference calls.
Looks like we keep on running into each other. Carl?
I'm Carl Hayden-Stratt. I'm IT specialist with GSA. I'm co-chair of the KM Working Group Technology Community and a grad student at George Mason University.
Great. Bob?
What's GSA?
General Services Administration.
Okay.
Bob?
I'm Bob Smith with Tall Tree Labs. I'm primarily interested in ontology management and currently recruiting for the Ontolog review of books. A librarian who's interested in looking at the work by Pollock on the intelligent information. I'd sure like some support. Right, Pat? Pat Cassidy is
I was reading a different book before until I just lost it. Now I'm going to have to start reading the Pollock book.
There you go.
Well, certainly, email me. There's a whole community out here, surely. You mean the Pollock Hodgson book?
Yes.
Were you talking about the Pollock Hodgson book that just came out? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Sure. Actually, we put that out on the PsyCop reading list and handed that out at the Army Duo Conference as one of the recommended readings. So, yeah, this
great.
Is Nancy.
Great. Oh, in the meantime, can I suggest that everyone speaks up while they're talking, and then when they are not, try to put yourself on mute. But don't put yourself on hold, because that would put music into the line. All right? Chris?
Hi. I'm Chris Welty from IBM Research. I've been doing some work on ontology methodology, which I'll talk about today.
Great. Adam?
Adam Pease at Articulate Software, which is a one-man consulting company. I've been leading the development of the suggested upper merged ontology since its inception and distributed on ontologyportal.org.
Okay, I know several people joined while I was struggling with the phone lines. May I know who else did I miss on the list?
Bill McCarthy.
Hi, Bill.
From Michigan State University.
Okay, who else? All right, so that's it. So let's give the floor to Chris. And I assume, oh, someone just joined us? All right. Okay.
Is that ascending or descending tone?
We need musicians here to tell. Okay,
yeah.
I'll give the floor to Chris and everyone. If you are on the VNC shared screen, you see Chris advancing the slides. If you can't get onto the VNC server, then please bring up your local copy of Chris's slides, and Chris will prompt us whenever he advances the slides. And that would be good for the recording anyway. Chris, all yours.
Okay. Thank you. So the title slide you should see says ontology-driven conceptual modeling, but really this is an overview of the OntoClean methodology. So
people who are on VNC, if you're expecting the screen to refresh and it doesn't, then there's a refresh tab on the VNC window. With the VNC window that you can press, and it will refresh the screen. Don't refresh your browser, but refresh the VNC viewer. Right, Chris.
Okay, so slide two. These are just some acknowledgments of other people who've contributed to this work. Of course, I did this work primarily with Nicola Guarino, who at the time was at a lab called LADCEB, and is that has changed to the Laboratory of Applied Ontology of the Italian National Research Council, where I am at the moment. Nicola sends his regards to everyone. He's been sort of watching this from the background, the Ontolog progress from the background. Other members of LOA and also Bill Anderson, who's at Ontology Works in Maryland, has also contributed by implementing the methodology in the product that they use to do database engagements. So slide three is basically the outline. So I'll basically just start with the slide four, which is entitled, What is Ontology? Nothing is showing up on... Well, maybe I need to refresh. So I'm not... Hold on a second, I've never used this before.
There's some auto features that might be trying to...
There we go. Okay. All right, so do I need to go through this? Are people familiar with what ontology is and what its history is? So I've just brought up all the points on slide four. Is this new to anyone?
Feel free to go forward.
Okay. So the point of these first couple slides is really more for a primarily computer science audience, where in particular that last bullet is relevant, that on page five there were some people that thought ontology was sort of a new name for something that object-oriented designers and database designers have been doing for, you know, a decade or more. And the point of these slides is to say, you know, ontology is quite a bit older than that, by 100 years or more, and that this is not a new name for an old thing. It's quite an old name. Okay, so again, sort of skipping quickly through this stuff, I'm assuming you people have heard plenty of background on what is an ontology, but I did want to get to that last bullet there. Okay, it doesn't show up on the screen on mine. Oh, there it is. Okay, so on slide six, that bottom. bottom bullet has some points that I think are pretty useful for helping people understand what information system ontologies are in terms of some of the properties that they should have. So I think they should provide some meaning, some clear and crisp meaning for terms that are used. They should help to organize the information. Typically, they organize things with a taxonomy, and that was one of the central elements for the methodology I'm going to discuss. They should reflect a common understanding and agreement as to what terms we should use and what they should mean. And obviously, that means establishing a vocabulary. And finally, and I think very importantly, the contribution of this work is that a good ontology should have some connection to the actual world. It should reflect the actual world. And that's how we should evaluate, at some level, the quality of an ontology, because that's where the word really comes from, as a description of what's really in the world. Okay, so slide 7. Probably would have been better to give a set of slides that didn't have animations in them. Okay, so here's a collection of things that people have at various times referred to as ontologies, and although philosophers may say that most of these things are not ontologies, we take a fairly neutral stance. As long as it's a theory of what matters to you or to your system, that's good enough for me. Okay, so slide 9. So the most important aspect of an ontology for people who build information systems is that they're engineered artifacts. People build them. They're like software systems in the sense that they have to be built and designed by people. They have to be analyzed and evaluated by people. They have to be maintained and extended over time. And ontologies, as we now know, this is one of the hottest areas in ontology research, is how they can be integrated with each other. And in general, there has not been very much guidance on how to go about doing this, even though there are a number of standard languages for representing ontologies, including OWL and Common Logic. Actually using those things build ontologies, it remains somewhat of an art, and it shouldn't be, in my opinion. It should be an engineering discipline. And so Nicole and I tried to embark on a project to help define some formal foundations for determining what makes an ontology good, and also how you evaluate decisions that need to be made during the ontology design process. Okay. Slide 10. Okay, so we're at the second bullet, I think. Yes. All right, so slide 11. So someone named Alan Rector, who some of you may be familiar with, he's a person who's been building medical ontologies for about 25 years, often has arguments with doctors about what the right way to represent medical information is. And the fact is that being familiar with, this has been proven numerous times in numerous ontology efforts, that being familiar with the domain doesn't make you the right person necessarily to build an ontology, just as being familiar with how a piece of software should work doesn't make you the best person to write the software itself. There's some skills that you need to have to build an ontology, just as there are for building bridges or building software. And we wanted to try to justify decisions that it seemed to us a lot of very experienced ontology designers agreed on certain points, that there was, from experience, a right way and a wrong way to go about making certain decisions, especially as it comes to using the subclass relationship. And a lot of that came from experience, and the motivation for this methodology was to try to provide a formal basis for why those decisions are correct. Okay, so slide 12. Historically, a lot of ontology efforts have failed. One of the reasons for this is that if you have a knowledge-based system, if you have a system that uses the knowledge as a central part of the way the system works, then if the knowledge is incorrect, your system isn't going to work. And it has nothing to do with the technology you may use. It's like blaming Java or blaming C++ because the software has bugs. The problem is that ontologies are built by people, and not everyone completely understands how to build ontologies. So we want to try to come up with a methodology that helps to make clear why a lot of experienced, so we're on slide 13, a lot of experienced ontology designers was that a new person? Why a lot of, so again on slide 13, why a lot of experienced ontology designers would look at these two choices for representing the same information and pick one and say this is obviously a better way to represent that information. And in fact, there is a, on slide 14, a problem that became fairly well known in the database world about 4 years ago, roughly 4 years ago, which is represented on the left side, and that is that you often have this need in object-oriented database systems and object-oriented design systems to generate a type restriction on some relation. So in this case, we want to say that we want to restrict what kinds of things can be parts of computers. So on the left side there, what we really intend to say is that disk drives and memory are the types of things that can be computer parts. And we don't really mean, which is what is logically entailed by that left diagram, that every disk drive is a computer part. And so in our methodology, we call the class represented by computer part there, we call that a role, because nothing is fundamentally a computer part, or at least these things are not fundamentally computer parts. They could be computer parts, but they could also be used in things that are not computers. This is a very recent paper that used this Giancarlo Guizzardi, who presented a paper at the Advanced Information Systems Engineering Conference this year, came up with a solution to this problem that basically uses the Ontoclean analysis to model things this way. And this basically gives you all the information that you might want out of a model. So the idea here is that computers have certain kinds of parts. And if you want to say that a disk drive and memory are computer parts, what we want to say is that no disk drive is essentially a computer part. It can be a computer part if it happens to be used in a computer. And that's what makes something a computer part. So we represent computer part as what we call the role. So a role is a class whose instances can stop being instances of that class. And disk drive, we call these kinds of classes types. That is, an instance of a disk drive cannot stop being an instance of a disk drive unless it's destroyed, unless it ceases to exist. So this gives us this taxonomy is basically supposed to show that a disk part is a subclass both of disk drive and computer part, and that a memory part is a subclass of both memory and computer part. But the link from memory part to memory is sort of more fundamental, in that every instance of memory part must be an instance of memory, but it doesn't have to be an instance of a computer part. It only becomes so when it's made a part of a computer. So if I want to claim that the right side model is a better way of representing the same information. I would like some formal basis for making that claim, and that's the purpose of the OntoClean methodology, to try to provide a formal basis for that. So, on slide 15, what we've basically developed here is a methodology for analyzing ontologies, and especially focusing on the subsumption relationship, the subclass relationship. And in particular, I want to point out that in the OntoClean work, which was published about 4 years ago with a few minor variations published later, we used the word property and metaproperty in the sense that it has in logic, which is a property for logicians is something that you would normally imagine representing as a unary predicate. So the property of being a person, properties represent the intention of a class. They represent the sort of the thing about a class that makes it different from just its member, the set of its members. So being a person is a property, having brown hair is a property, having no hair is a property. Again, these could be represented as unary predicates in logic. However, in the semantic web, used the same word property specifically to mean a binary predicate. So I'm maintaining the same terminology that we used in the papers. I just want to point out, hopefully to avoid confusion, that when we use property, we mean a class, basically. And a meta-property is, again, a property of classes, so a class of classes, in a sense, and not the semantic web meaning, which is basically a binary predicate or a relation. Okay, so slide 16 is another orientation slide. We're moving into the formal foundation part of the talk. One of the things that we wanted to do, one of the places that we started in doing this work, especially Nicola, was that given the several century-old tradition of ontology and philosophy, that it was just impossible for us to imagine that there was nothing useful that could have come out of several centuries of thinking about how to represent logically the kinds of things that existed in the world, since this was obviously very similar to what we wanted to do in information systems. But we just didn't want to take all of philosophy, which ends up getting involved in discussions that are better held in pubs, really. And what we found was that the way in which philosophers argue, and not the arguments themselves, but again, the analysis they use to try to pick apart each other's arguments were important and could be used to analyze the artifacts that we build in information systems. And so we tried to characterize these formally as meta-properties, again, properties of classes, and I'll talk about what those are, and use those properties to... Hello? Okay. I'm hearing a lot of noise on the line.
Right. So if people could put their phones on mute, that would be helpful. Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. I have a tendency to speak very fast. Is there some protocol for asking a question?
It would be up to you. Would you prefer questions in the middle of the presentation, or you want to save that to at the end?
How long do we have scheduled?
The whole thing could be 1.5 to 2 hours. Generally, if you do a 1 hour presentation, that will leave about like half an hour for discussion.
Okay. Yeah, so it seems a long way to go without stopping for questions. So I'm happy to take questions as we go, but we need some way to interrupt me. When people are live, they raise their hands.
So if anyone... anyone has questions, just say so. And please identify yourself before asking the questions. That might help since we don't get to see everybody's face. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. So we're on slide 18. All right, so a quick overview of what the notions that we borrowed from philosophy are. What the key one is the first one, identity. So if you ever take the time to read work in philosophical metaphysics or ontology, you'll find that identity is the basis for most arguments and most of the more fundamental positions in philosophical ontology. Identity basically is a way of formalizing the what seems like an obvious fact that in order for entities to exist in the universe, which is the starting place of ontology, that the universe exists and there are entities in it, in order for an entity to exist, we must be able to tell that there is another entity that isn't the first one. So we must be able to tell things apart. In order to know that there are three chairs in the room, we have to be able to count them. In order to count them, we have to know that they're different. So how do we know that they're different? And then over time, how do we know that, you know, for people, for example, how do we know that it's the same person entering the room that we saw a week ago or a few minutes ago even? And so these are called identity criteria, and they're very important in metaphysical arguments. Unity are the criteria by which we know that one thing is a whole entity as opposed to being a part of something else. So if I'm looking at a chair that's standing on the floor, somehow I'm able to tell that the chair is one thing and it's not the floor, even though they're connected. And some of these things happen just by fiat. For example, constellations we recognize as being whole because we're taught to recognize which stars are members of the constellation. Essence is the first thing I'll talk about. Essence has to do with properties of entities that are not allowed to change. So a property is essential to an entity if that entity cannot change whether it has that property or not. Dependence has to do with the existence of other entities or other classes given the instance of one. And then actually a new one for that we've been still the last one on slide 18, permanence. This is something that is studied also in temporal databases, the idea of how entities behave with respect to time. Okay, so we're on slide 19. So one of the most often in the follow-up work to Antoclin, one of the most often cited of the meta-properties that we outlined was rigidity. So the basic idea of rigidity is that we have this notion of essentiality. So, for example, a pillow is essentially soft. It's part of the definition of being a pillow that it be soft, at least according to some person's conceptualization of pillow. And let me point out here, and I'll say this several times more, I'm using examples here, but the point of this presentation is not to say that, you know, if you say pillow, if you disagree that pillows must be soft, you're wrong. The point here is to say that in one ontology, I may decide that the notion of being a pillow is essentially tied to the notion of being soft, okay? And that's one way of representing that information. And understanding that it's essential, that being soft is essential to pillows, should be part of the formal representation of my ontology because it helps me to express what I mean by being a pillow. And it would help me to understand that someone else who represents pillows that can be hard, that their notion of pillow is different from mine. So let's say that I believe that pillows are essentially soft, that, again, part of the definition of a pillow is that it's soft. If it ceases to be soft, it ceases to be a pillow. And John must be a person. for me as an entity to change the fact that I'm an instance of a person. So that's a fairly common notion in metaphysics, but we wanted to be a little bit more particular and recognize that certain classes are a little bit more special than that. In particular, certain classes are essential to every single one of their instances. So the property of being soft, you can imagine the class of all soft things, some of those things are essentially soft, like pillows, and some of those things are not, like a sponge, for example, can be soft when it's wet and not soft when it's dry. Whereas being a person is essential to every instance of person, at least in what I would consider a normal understanding of person, but at least in my ontology, the class of persons is essential to every instance of a person. If any instance of a person stops being an instance of a person, it means that that instance has ceased to exist. And so we call these rigid. So they're the class. So rigid is a property of properties, a property of classes. And it's a rigid class is a class all of whose instances must always be instances of that class. And so I'm going to skip over the formalizations. I don't know if anyone considers those important, but they take a lot of time to go over. So I'll skip that, but let me just pause for a minute. Okay. Here we go. And just with this, on slide 19, the definition of rigidity, to see if there were any questions on this one before I move to the next one. Okay.
Please go on.
Okay. All right. So we're on slide 21 now. So the idea of identity, and sometimes identity and unity, the difference between them may be a bit subtle. So identity are the way in which we recognize objects as being different, and really formally, identity is a relation between is a relation that tells me that two things are the same. Now that always sounds rather confusing, because how can two things be the same? It doesn't make any sense. But I really mean this as a logical formula. So if I have two variables, I want to be able to conclude that those two, the values of those two variables refer to the same thing. And identity are the criteria that we use to make that determination. And a consequence of being able to conclude that, again, two things are equal is obviously also to be able to conclude that two things are different if they don't satisfy those identity criteria. And a lot of times, it's a bit easier to understand identity as the property that tells us when things are different. We also separated the idea of identity over time versus identity at a single point in time. So identity over time is what lets me conclude, for example, that a dog is my dog. Whereas unity are the criteria that lets me identify all the parts of a whole entity and understand recognize that there are parts of that entity. So in this case, the collar is not part of the dog, but how do I know that? How do I define what makes the parts of the dog and what doesn't? So formally, I'll just talk about this a little bit. Formally, identity criteria in that first bullet there are defined to be this relation that uses the Greek letter, I think that's a rho. It's basically a relation between two things, again, that lets me conclude that they're equal, and that if two things are equal, that this relation holds between them, okay? And the point here is that the relation, for certain properties, for certain classes, represented here in this first formula by phi, for certain classes, the relation is the same for every instance of that class. And so we call these identity criteria. The relation, the way that we tell things are the same or different varies with certain kinds of classes, and these classes are going to be special in our methodology. And so we modified the more classic formulation a little bit to be more general, and I don't think that's important. On slide 23 here, we tried to differentiate between, again, the way of telling identity that's particular to a class when an entity is an instance of that class versus identity criteria that must always hold for an instance. And so here, the notion is that, for example, a student is a classic example of a class of entities where no instance of a student is necessarily an instance of student. Any student can stop being a student. But we have, at least colleges have, this sort of artificial identity criteria for students. They usually give them a registration number or use their social security number to identify them. And that student identification number, at least, will only hold as long as the person is a student, and probably, unless it's the social security number, probably won't be used or couldn't be used to identify them after they cease to be a student. So the idea of local identity is that it holds whenever an instance is an instance of a particular class, whereas the global identity criteria should hold as long as an entity exists.
Chris, Peter Yim here.
Yes.
What does IC stand for here? Instance of
identity criteria.
Oh, identity criteria.
Okay. So slide 24. Coming up with identity criteria themselves, coming up with the formal criteria for identity is not always easy. In fact, the arguments on what the proper identity criteria for people are go on and on forever. It's very, very difficult to figure out how we do it. There's no doubt that we are able to identify people, but the process is probably not one that could be formalized in logic. What we were trying to do is simplify that notion in a way that could be captured in a formal language, but I won't say we've completely succeeded. What we're trying to do now is build up a library of common identity criteria, and I'll give a couple of examples of that as we go through the examples later on in the talk. And so what we said was it's actually useful to know if a class has identity criteria associated with it, and if so, we give it the meta property plus I. And the plus O meta property basically tells us that it's a little bit less important, but tells us that a class has some new contribution to the identity criteria down the taxonomy. Okay, and then if you don't have identity, if a class does not have an identity criteria for all its instances, then we give it the minus I meta property that says it does not have identity criteria.
Could you give an example of a class that does not have an identity criteria?
Sure. So if we imagine a class of red things, for example, you know, tables can be red, chairs, walls, people, cars, and the assumption here is that the identity criteria for cars is different than the identity criteria for chairs and for people, and so that the class of red things does not have an identity criteria that applies to all its instances. All right, unity criteria is it's a relationship. It's represented in this on slide 25. As this, what letter is that? What Greek letter? I forget.
Omega.
Anyway, is that an omega? I can't read it. It's coming out strange on my computer. Anyway, let's say that's omega. So the lowercase omega between Y and Z is a relation, basically, that holds between all the parts of an entity. So the idea here is to try to say that there's the parts of an entity, we know they're all parts of that whole entity. If we somehow know how to draw the boundaries of that entity, and we're able to tell what is and isn't a part of it. And the classic example of an entity that does not have Unity is an amount of stuff. So it's certainly possible for me, if I really wanted to look at the table in front of me and say, I want to draw a little, you know, with my finger, just imagine a little circle and say, I want to talk about the wood that's right here in this table. And that entity, in a sense, is what the philosophers call a mere collection. That is, the boundaries are just established by fiat, and there's really no way to tell what the boundaries of that entity are because it's a mere entity. It's an arbitrary entity. And in that case, it's an entity that does not have a unity criteria, and there are infinitely many such entities in the universe.
May I ask a question here?
Yes.
This is an issue which has bothered me, because in the real world, my feeling is that we do, in fact, that every object we talk about is of the type where we are drawing arbitrary boundaries, although the arbitrary boundary may be extremely fine-grained. Objects may, for example, have adhered air molecules adhering to each other just by intramolecular interaction. And these may go along with the object. Every place the object goes, the air molecules adhere, go too. And the question then is, how do you draw a boundary in reality for physical objects? And if you want to say, all right, you have to specify, let us say we have a sphere of gold, and only gold atoms are part of that. Okay, well, then you get to a certain point, and you ask the question, where is the boundary beyond which the object no longer exists? Since quantum mechanically we know that can go out to infinity, although it's the probability of an electron of that gold atom being a mile away from the gold ring you have on your finger is exceedingly small. Nevertheless, it's finite. So what you're doing is you're drawing some arbitrary probability in order to define the boundary of that object. And so, although philosophically you can imagine such things, in the real world, I have the suspicion that when you try to analyze it at the lowest level, every object is a fiat object. Okay, that's my problem with this unity criterion.
Okay, it's actually not a problem with unity criteria. It's a particular philosophical position that unity criteria points out, which is that it is a well-established philosophical view that, in fact, every object is just by is an object by fiat, and that the only thing fundamentally there are the particles, or perhaps even, you know, below the particles at the subatomic level, and that, you know, everything that we perceive is just a product of our own perceptual system and not fundamentally there in the universe. And in that case, nothing has unity criteria, and that's part of your ontology. So the unity criteria here does not make a commitment that there are holes. It just lets you make a difference between things that are, that someone may claim is fundamentally whole, versus someone who says nothing is fundamentally whole. Does that help?
But I'm wondering if there's some kind of middle, like we can say that for physical objects, that if it moves the object, we're going to consider it a part of the object, even if it's just adhered. Like one of the questions you have is the paint on the surface of a car part of the car? Well, normally we'd say yes. It has some degree of adhesion. Well, suppose you had a bird dropping on the car. That adheres, and it's solidified pretty well. Now, has that become part of the car by the fact that it's adhering very well? I'm wondering if we can define some criterion for that. I mean, is it invariably arbitrary?
Is this Bill or Pat?
This is Pat talking.
Hi, sorry. I think it is arbitrary. If you don't think the bird dropping is part of the car, then you should say so in your ontology. You should specify that there are cars and they have parts, and these are the kinds of things that can be would include, if you wanted, saying the kinds of things that you might mistakenly think are parts of cars and aren't, like the bird droppings, like the tar, you know, like the remains of the dog I ran over, and so forth. But there may be an ontology which considers that to be part of the car because, you know, if it hears enough, you know, that's my definition. And these are the kinds of subtleties that should be exposed if they matter. You know, for the, at some level, we have to remember, I think, that we're doing information systems design and not really trying to get it absolutely perfect down to the last level of detail, because that is what philosophers have been doing in metaphysics for hundreds of years, and they still haven't got it. So there's reason to believe that that's going to be a very long enterprise.
Okay, just one more question. I don't want to take up too much time, but if we have a car and you decide that every car, let us say it's part of your ontology, that every car must have a motor in it or it's not a car. Now, if you take the motor out for repair and yet you still say, well, this is actually the motor that belongs to that car. The question I'm having here is, I know you can arbitrarily define these things, but I'm wondering if you have a specific recommended solution for these problems. For this specific problem, when do you have an object that's disassembled?
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty difficult ontological problem. There's this famous problem of the boat of Theseus, which is basically formulated as you know, if I take the boat of Theseus and I replace it one plank at a time. You know, during no intermediate stage would I consider it a different boat. And then by the time I'd finished, you know, I would have replaced every part of the boat, yet I did it in such an incremental way that at no point in time would anyone have thought of it as a different boat. But then if I took all of the planks that I originally replaced and built a new boat out of it, you know, the way they did with the London Bridge, for example, some people may argue that the boat that I just built out of the original planks is the boat, whereas other people may argue that the boat that has all the new planks is the boat. And, you know, there's really no way to solve that problem generally. You just have to decide, you know, how I'm going to define my identity criteria for boat, and that includes problems like this. You know, is it the same car if I take the engine out and put a new engine in? Is it the same car if I take the engine, if I replace the body but leave the engine the same? You know, it's up to you. You define what that means in your ontology, and doing that to the as much as possible will help define what you mean by a car or by a boat.
Okay, thank you. I think I agree. That's what I was wondering.
And so our goal here, again, I give a bunch of examples, but I don't mean to claim that the examples are universally true, but I hope the meta properties that I discuss help expose these kinds of problems, these kinds of differences in what people mean by the classes that they have in their ontologies. So slide 26 gives sort of a general overview of what unity criteria give you. Basically, the plus U meta property tells you that all instances of a class are whole objects under the same criteria for determining it's a whole. And minus U tells you that either some of my instances are not wholes or some of my instances are holes but under different unity criteria. And so, you know, minus U, the class of red things, for example, may be minus U because, you know, some mere sum of things could be red but not whole. And then minus U is for really mainly mere sums. This is on slide 26. Mere sums of things generally do not have unity criteria. And again, if you think everything is a mere sum, then nothing has unity criteria. Okay, So slide 27, property dependence. There are actually, I think, in the philosophical, in the logical community, excuse me, there are on the order of 10 different kinds of dependence. Ontological dependence is basically the idea that certain things and certain classes can't exist, or their actual existence implies the existence of other things or other classes. We picked one that seemed particularly intuitive, but in the work since then, we've sort of identified several others that also seem pretty important. But for the purposes of this talk, I'll stick with this. The idea here is that, for example, with if we consider student to be a class, then it's impossible for there to be an instance of a student unless there's a corresponding teacher. So for every instance of some class, there exists an instance of some other class. And we, rather than represent this as a relationship between the two classes, again, we were looking for these meta properties to be able to assign. So if a class is dependent on some other class in this way, then we consider that property, that class, to be dependent. Okay, on slide 28, we've been thinking recently about something that we're for the moment calling permanence. This is an idea that's also in temporal databases. And the idea is to try to characterize, and I actually don't think I have time to go through this, so I'll just give you very quickly, to try to characterize the idea that certain classes have behaviors with respect to, their instances behave in particular ways with respect to time. And so if you look at these three examples of person that are on slide 28, the idea here is that all three of these different meanings of person would actually be rigid. So in the first case, a person sort of begins, any instance of person begins its existence as a living person and at some point becomes a dead person and then maintains that for the rest of time. So the person class is rigid, but both the living person and dead person class are non-rigid, or in fact anti-rigid. In the second ontology, person is a class of things, and basically the idea here is that if you were ever a person, you're forever a person. And then in the third idea, and again that would also be rigid. And then in the third idea, third ontology, person is a class, it's a rigid class, and when, in essence, when people die, we consider them to no longer be existing. So in that third ontology, for example, I could not say that Aristotle is Chris's ancestor. I could not represent that relation in the third ontology because Aristotle no longer is. So the idea here is that these three ontologies, the term person is used differently. It means something different in each of them, and none of the meta properties that I discussed so far would expose these differences. And really, in some sense, that's the goal of this methodology. One of the main goals of this methodology is to be able to help characterize what the differences between very similar classes might be. And so here we have an example where we have clearly different but very similar uses of the same class. And I would like some way to be able to say they're different using this analysis, and permanence would help there. But I won't go into that anymore to say we're working on that. Okay, I think most of you are probably familiar with the idea of upper-level ontology, so I won't go into that too much. I think they're valuable. Participated in the past in the SUO effort, don't have time for it anymore. We focused in OntoClean on the one particular aspect of upper-level ontologies, which is an ontology of universals. So on slide 31, one of the fundamental distinctions in formal ontology is the difference between particulars Particulars are things that have no instances, and universals, and universals are things that do have instances, so they're represented in logic by predicates. So we focused actually on using these meta properties to build an ontology of properties, because we felt that, again, where I'm using property is roughly synonymous with class, these were the central aspects of most ontologies, and we felt that there was more to classes than just whether or not it was a class. And in particular, semantic web languages treat classes as purely extensional, that is, they're defined purely as the set of their members, and there's more to classes than that, and so that's what these meta properties were intended to capture. So on slide 32, by just using the combinatorics of the different meta properties that I introduced here, and then given some of the logical formalizations of those meta properties, some combinations are just impossible. And it gave us basically 8 different kinds of classes that you could have in an ontology. And the most important ones, I think, are the 4 that are circled. Okay. So type, role, attribution, and category. A category is basically a usually very high-level classes. They're rigid. That is, every instance must be an instance of it, but they carry no identity criteria because they're very, very general. So things like abstract versus concrete or universal versus particular. Attributions are these classes that are frequently added to ontologies just to help organize the, if you have a hierarchy that's not very deep but very broad, sometimes people introduce categories just for their own conceptual purposes to help add some order to the ontology, but the classes themselves don't have any formal meaning. They usually introduce some organized things, maybe by color or by gender, for example, and we consider those attributions. And then roles play a very important part in this ontology of properties. Roles, again, are the classes that usually represent that their instances are playing some part in a relation or in an event.
Can I ask another question? I'm sorry.
Yep.
About the attributions. You approve of classification by attribution, it seems?
Again,
red things,
the
class of red things is a perfectly legitimate class, I imagine.
So, I'm making trying not to make too many judgments here, just trying to capture an ontology of the things that are in ontologies.
You've red circled the attribution category.
Yes, so I've circled it because I think it's a fundamental kind of class.
Okay.
But in a upcoming slide, I'll say that I don't consider them particularly important.
Okay, but I've also one extension. I've seen classifications where a category is classification of X by color, and then under that you have red things, blue things, yellow things. So the X by color would seem to be simply a union of all of the attribution classes, and would not itself... I can't think of any property that X by color class would have by itself. And I imagine you've run into this, and I wonder what your thoughts are.
I would say the union of all the classes of color, of things with color, is the class of all colored things. Not everything has color. My ideas don't have colors, property, universals don't have color, abstract
well,
things.
Well, flowers.
The
flowers by, I've seen, for example, you have a class saying flowers, and then you have
mm-hmm.
flowers by color, flowers
mm-hmm.
by number of pistils, flowers by number of petals, flowers by height. Now, of course, these classes are not disjoint. They're completely overlapping. yet you, people find such classifications useful, and I'm wondering what the formal status of this thing is. Flowers by color. Flowers.
Okay,
by
so yeah, you have to. One of the things that comes out of this methodology is, in order to understand the right status of a class, you need to know what its instances are. Even if you're introducing a class just purely for your own, to help you, you know, which I'm sure most of us have done in building ontologies, is we get to a point where one class has so many subclasses and it's getting hard to figure out what's what anymore, and we just try to organize them a little bit more. But it's important when you do that, and perhaps the most useful thing of this methodology at all is that it forces you to think a little bit harder about what your classes mean. When you create a class in an ontology, you have to know what its instances are. So if you have a class called Flowers by Color, you know, I'd like to know what its instances are. And it sounds like its instances are all exactly the same as the instances of flower. So it sounds like that class has no meaning.
Well, the only uniform characteristic I could imagine when worrying about this was that this is a class of flowers whose color has been defined. And say that there is some instance level attribution of color.
There you go.
And that's the only criterion I can think of.
Right, but the important point is to specify that meaning. And as long as there is one, it seems fine to me.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, so on slide 33, one of the most important things that philosophers in metaphysics, at least in one branch of metaphysics, talk about are sortals. The intuition behind sortals is that they are, some people have called them natural kinds. They are the classes that when we look at an object, it's the first thing we think of when looking at that object in order to classify it. Things like chair, table, person, horse. And in order to try to capture that, the fact that that clearly happens, in order to capture that formally, the notion of a sortal was introduced. And the idea here was that a sortal is a class from which entities in the universe get their identity criteria. The idea, again, the intuition here is that identity criteria get more and more specific as you move down a taxonomy, and that we use the identity criteria and the unity criteria from the most specific class in a taxonomy to tell us when things are the same and when they're different, and that when you get past a certain point in the taxonomy, these classes are no longer really offering anything as far as identity is concerned. Now, that's never really been proved either psychologically or formally, but it turns out to be a useful notion to keep in designing ontologies, because we want to be able to recognize a certain subset of the classes in the ontology, which I'm going to call the okay, I'm sort of lost in my own presentation here. Hold on a second. Oh, that's bad. All right, bear with me for a moment. I just lost my...
You're on 33, weren't you?
Yeah, I was on 33, but expecting 36. Okay, I was expecting slide 36 to be the next one. Okay. In a fit of dementia, obviously, I changed my slides. So I'll just. Oops. Is there some way to jump to a particular slide? Peter?
I actually don't know.
Okay. All right. So anyway, this is quite vicarious. Anyway, the idea here is that this ontology of types of classes helps you, first of all, to further specify what you mean by the classes in your ontology. So if two people have a class with the same name, but in one ontology it's an attribution, and another ontology it's a type, it must mean that we have different things in mind by those properties. And again, that's one of the main goals of this methodology, is to help people understand differences between the classes and their ontology. Okay, I'll take over. Thanks. Willard Quine is a famous philosopher in formal ontology who established a lot of what is considered standard ontology today. In fact, it was reading Quine that led John McCarthy to introduce the word ontology into the computer science vocabulary. He says that he said no entity without identity. And the idea here is that it's impossible for there to be entities unless there is identity criteria. And so we take that to mean that every entity must get its identity. We have this notion of identity criteria to mean that classes basically provide the identity to their instances. And so the rigid classes that have identity criteria are considered to be what we call the backbone taxonomy. The backbone taxonomy is a subset of the classes in your ontology arranged in whatever taxonomic order they were specified to be in, and the backbone taxonomy are the classes that we know that every instance must be, for all their existence, instances of something in the backbone taxonomy, okay? Because we require that every entity get its identity from a rigid class. Moving to slide 37, we basically have a bunch of constraints that sort of formally are entailed by the axioms that we use to define these metaproperties. One of the most important ones is the rigidity constraint, which says basically that no anti-rigid class. Remember, anti-rigid means that an entity must possibly not be an instance of that class, and rigid means every instance of the class must always be, must essentially be an instance of that class. So if that's the case, then it's impossible for anti-rigid class to subsume a rigid class, because by the definition of subsumption, if I say that some object here, O10, is an instance of some property P, then by subsumption it must also be an instance of property Q. But if Q is anti-rigid, it means it must be possible for that entity to cease being an instance of Q. So if I take that link away, which the animation is supposed to show, it's supposed to come back. I guess I have to press it again. There we go. It comes back. So the idea here is that since O10 cannot stop being an instance of P, by the definition of subsumption, every P is a Q. So I can't break the link between this entity and the class Q, but the definition of anti-rigid requires that it be possible. So there's a logical contradiction there. That was on slide 37. On slide 38, slightly less formalized here is the idea that identity criteria have to be compatible. So slide 39, I'll skip over the slide 38. Slide 39 says the identity criteria for classes its name that every ordered set is a set. But if we look at the identity criteria, we see that the identity criteria for sets allow us to say that the set of elements ABC is the same as the set of elements BAC, because mathematically sets have no order. Okay, so if I write BAC and CAB as sets of elements, the identity criteria for sets tell me that those are the same set. But ordered sets do depend on order, and so those two sets are different ordered sets. So, in fact, if my identity criteria for set tells me that order is not important, then it's impossible for an ordered set to be a set, because it means that the same entity, according to the superclass, are two different entities, according to the subclass, and that can't be. Go ahead.
Okay, this is important, actually, but as I recall, at least in one book on set theory, for the reasons you cited, they define ordered sets as being the set of sets where the order is implied in the set. You have first part 1 and 2, you know, 1, and then you have 1 and 2, and then you have 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, and that set of all of those subsets then is the ordered set. I know that's not the ordered set in the normal sense of what we're thinking, and I agree with what you're saying. But I'm wondering...
Yeah, so, in that case, you have a different identity criteria. So the point here is, in order to be logically consistent, your identity criteria have to be compatible with every other... You know, if you want to say an ordered set is a subclass of a set, then you need to define identity criteria for both of those that make it work. Okay, and so the quickest way around that problem is just to create a class is to have no identity criteria for set, or have the identity criteria for set allow both of those things, and then create an unordered set, for example, as a subset that has a different identity criteria than ordered set. And the point here is that, you know, the harder you think about what your classes mean, the better chance you have of really exposing subtle kinds of differences that can break information systems. Okay, and so there's a bunch of criteria, a bunch of actual constraints on the subsumption relationship that follow from the formalizations on slide 41 summarizes what they are. And so it's important to see there that while identity criteria are sometimes difficult to conceive of, knowing that a class has identity criteria, even if you can't formalize it, is enough to give you some ordering constraints to help you verify at least the ontological consistency of a taxonomy. Okay, so it's been about an hour and 15 minutes or hour and 10 minutes since I started. I have about 10 more minutes of slides, but I've stopped basically. I've finished the sort of formal presentation, so I can either continue with some of these pitfall examples or move to questions.
I suggest that you continue with the pitfall examples.
Okay, is everyone in agreement?
Yeah, sure. Pitfalls are always the most fun.
Okay, so slide 43. Okay. All right, so since many formal representation systems give you only the subclass relationship, it tends to be the most commonly misused relation in ontologies. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it. It just means people need to be a little bit more clear about what a class is and what its instances are before building a taxonomy. And don't use, the point of this section is basically don't use the subclass relationship when you really mean something else. Probably the most common misuse is on slide really instantiation. So in this example, we have a class called ThinkPad model and a class called T21, and we have a particular ThinkPad, and we consider it an instance of a T21. Now, the problem with this model, if you really think about it, is that my ThinkPad becomes a ThinkPad model, which doesn't really make sense. It's not a model, it's a ThinkPad. So, skipping to slide 45, a slightly better way to represent that would be, again, to think about what the classes that you have in your ontology mean. What are their instances? So if I have a class called ThinkPad Model, when I represent this class, what am I imagining an instance of a ThinkPad model is? Okay? So I may not be able to clarify its identity criteria, but to make the attempt is really important, because the first thing you do in trying to characterize the identity criteria for a class is think of a couple of example instances and how I can tell them apart. So in this case, it turns out what I meant by ThinkPad model were things like a T21. This happens to be a model of IBM ThinkPad. If that's what I meant by a ThinkPad model, then the previous ontology was wrong, and this one is a lot better, because I had instances of ThinkPad model that actually weren't models. And because it was a higher level class, it may not ever have occurred to the person building the model, and this happens all the time, to actually think about what its instances are, because a lot of people are accustomed to only looking at the leaves of the ontology and imagining what their instances are. But every class has to have that understanding. And so it would not be the case that, say, so the blue link there, a better way to represent this would be to separate the idea of having a particular model versus being an instance. Okay, so a particular ThinkPad is an instance of a computer, and I might want to subclass that a little bit more, but it's not an instance of a model. Okay, on slide 46, and again, on that previous example, it's not what I meant by model. That's not to say that you couldn't build an ontology that correctly divided the world of computers in an ontology by their model number, as long as you understand what the class really means. So slide 46, probably the second most common pitfall, misuse of subsumption, is the composition relation. This is a little bit more subtle, but here I'm trying to represent what computers are made of, and this happens a lot, especially for people just starting off, because the parts. What am I trying to say? Thinking about the parts of an object that can be decomposed considerably, like computers, like fairly complex artifacts like computers and cars, you really look like you're talking about a hierarchy, because the bigger thing, the computer, contains a bunch of smaller things like the disk drive and memory, and a disk drive has even smaller parts, or in this case, there are different kinds of disk drives. So in fact, I'm mixing two meanings of the subclass relationship. And what this person actually meant was that disk drives and memory are part of computers. Okay, and again, I'm not calling the previous taxonomy necessarily wrong. It's just that if this is what you meant, then this is how you should represent it. So don't use the subclass relation to represent the part of relation. Again, another very, very common pitfall is representing these sort of artificial classes, what in the ontoclean analysis would be exposed as a role, I'm basically inventing this computer part class to create a restriction on the has part relation from computers. So I want to sort of lump together all the things that can be computer parts so that I can more easily express the constraint on that relationship. That happens all the time. And in most cases, if you really think about what you meant by the class computer part, you'll realize that this is a mistake, because if you read the subclass relation as every instance of the subclass is an instance of the superclass, it's simply not the case that every disk drive is a computer part. Because I mean, in this case, by a computer part, that it's something that's part of a computer. But not every disk drive is part of a computer. Earlier, I showed a much cleaner example of how to represent this particular problem on slide 49. Okay, well, if you sort of space through slide 48, the final animation shows a camera that has a flash card in it. And since flash card is an instance of memory, we imply that this flash card is a computer part when clearly it's not. It's a part of a camera. So on slide 49, one way of sort of better representing what I meant here is just to use disjunction and logic if you have it. And then much earlier on, I showed this sort of five-part representation of how you, another way to represent this that actually gives you some pretty elegant results, including being able to conclude that any disk drive used in a computer is a computer part and not anything that's used in something else. Okay, on slide 50, there's a lexical resource called Microcosmos, which was developed at New Mexico State University, which dealt with the polysemy problem. The polysemy is basically that certain words have multiple meanings, and they basically chose to use the subclass relationship to represent polysemy. The idea here being that there's a sort of a physical manifestation of every book and this abstract idea of every book. And, you know, I can use the same word to refer to both of those, and typically from context we understand which one is meant. So Microcosmos, again, chose to use the subclass relationship to represent that, which just is absolute nonsense. And on slide 51, it's just clearly the case that you don't lump things together because in natural language we happen to use the same word to mean multiple things. You, as in WordNet, you break up the meaning of those words. WordNet did it by creating sets of synonyms, and any word can be a member of any number of sets of synonyms, each one of those memberships indicating a different meaning for that. A different meaning that there could be for that word. Okay, so slide 52, there are some problems with WordNet, in particular this one. This is very common in a lot of different ontologies. You find the subclass relation being used to represent the fact that physical objects are typically understood to be things that have some existence in space and time, that physical objects are amounts of matter. And the idea here is that if you think about what an instance of an amount of matter is, at least as I would imagine is meant by having the word amount in there, if I have an amount of clay in my hand, in one hand, and then another amount of clay in my other hand, and I smush them together, I have a new amount of clay because it's a different amount. So at least as I would interpret what the identity criteria of amount of matter must be, if the amount changes, it's a different amount. Whereas if I take some physical object and scratch a bunch of matter off of it, like if I take a knife and scrape a bunch of plastic off the casing of my ThinkPad, it's not going to become a different computer, even though the amount of matter that it's constituted of will be. And so this happens a lot, actually. The there's a very common confusion between the constitution relationship and subclass, and also the constitution relationship and the composition relationship, the part of relationship. So if a computer is made of, you know, if I have a keyboard that's made of plastic, plastic is not part of my keyboard. It's just what it's made of. And the material that it's made of is the constitution relationship, and then the parts that it has is the part of relationship. Okay, and so on slide 53 we see the better way of representing that information. This was actually just pointed out to me today that all of these example slides don't have the meta properties on them, which I apologize for. So they were supposed to, and I sort of invented this presentation by munging together a bunch of other presentations, and this was meant as sort of an initial motivation for the kinds of things that the analysis will expose. And when I invented this shorter presentation, I neglected to put the meta properties in. So anyway, in this example of constitution, it's the unity criteria that expose this problem, at least with what's the model, that's the ontology that's shown on slide 52. And slide 53, at least, obeys the meta property constraints. Okay. So, all right. That's it with some of the pitfalls that we found in using the subsumption relation. So I think I'll stop there.
Okay, so Chris, thank you very much for the presentation.
You're welcome.
And how would you suggest if we want to learn more about this work?
I think the best place to start is the article in CACM. If you go to my webpage, there's a publications link let's see. So if you click on my link in the wiki, you get to a bio that has a link to my homepage,
okay.
And then on the left column of my homepage there's a link for publications,
yeah.
And in that, about five bullets down, is an article that was published in CACM. IBM won't let me put it on my webpage, but I think if you go to the LOA webpage, in very small font up on the right, in a yellow background, is a link to the LOA webpage. I think they have the PDF of the article there. The link that's on my webpage goes to the ACM portal, so you need it'll only work if you have access to the ACM Digital Library.
Hey, I'm now on the LAO page.
Yeah, so they have. Let me go there.
That
was it looks like it's there. If you go to the publications link and then scroll down to 2002, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth one down. There's a PDF link and
evaluating ontological decisions with OntoClean.
Yes, that's
okay.
It.
I don't see it. Sixth one. Two. Three.
So it's the sixth one down under 2002.
So if I have the PDF link, I can just email it to Peter. He could post it.
No, I'm trying to get.
No, I wouldn't. Not. I mean, be careful about posting it. I'm not sure the legality of posting it. Apparently, LOA is willing to take the risk.
Well, I mean,
but
we could
the
post
copyright is held by ACM.
Right, but you could post a link to the PDF file on the LOA site.
Yes, that's fine. I think that's fine. Anyway, yeah, sounds good to me.
So I don't think that's copyright against posting a URL.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I'm not a lawyer.
great. Thank you.
I'd just like to bring up the fact that, you know, I'm, of course, new to this, but I'm just wondering what kind of play this has then with our earlier conference call that says, you know, if you start building from the bottom up versus building from the top down, is there more call or less call for OntoClean's purposes that would expose some of these issues?
No, whether you start from the bottom, top, or middle, or sort of mix it around, it doesn't matter. As long as when you identify a class that you want in your ontology, the point here is that you go through a little bit more rigor in expressing what you mean by that class. And so, again, I said this once before, that one of the main values of the methodology is actually that in order to try to decide whether a class, you know, what the meta properties of a particular class are, it forces you to think a little bit harder about what you mean than you would have if you had no methodology. And so,
but then does it relate back to what you had said at the beginning, the skill sets and the perspective of the person who's building the ontology? If you're looking at it from a larger perspective on a higher level ontology versus building the domain ontology up, is it easier to have some sort of, I guess, more refined classification system that you're starting with, than rather building up and finding, oops, logic era or class era should be this? I'm just, when you talked earlier about the skill sets, and was that this conference call? I think you had mentioned something about the skill set for ontologists.
I mentioned that having some experience building ontologies would make you more qualified to build ontologies than a doctor. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, there's some debate, of course, in the arena of, say, for instance, Army has a content management policy that they've written, and there's some contention that perhaps you need someone who is skilled at writing ontology working with the domain experts as a team, because there are language specific skills in the domain person that might not exist in the ontology expert. But to combine those skills as you produce it would be important to have that team working together.
Absolutely. I mean, this is understood in the software engineering community, for example. It's certainly understood in most engineering disciplines that you can't expect someone who's never done something before to get it right the first time. And you can't expect an ontologist, you know, someone who has experience building ontologies, to walk into a surgical room, you know, the operating room, and understand everything that's going on. But you don't expect that doctor to sit in front of a computer and understand how to build an ontology. It's an engineered artifact, and every engineering discipline has some training that's required in order for someone to proceed. You know, it goes for software engineering and goes for all other forms of engineering too, and I think should apply to ontology engineering as well. Is that what you meant?
Yes, I was just trying to find out your experiences in that, and also to see if there were some policies out there, maybe some experiments out there that showed the value of having maybe that team and the product that they were delivering, the quality of the product that they were delivering.
Yes, we have one formal experiment in which basically we took an ontology that was designed by someone who had absolutely no experience designing an ontology, and, you know, no criticism of the guy. He just happened to be the one selected to do it. And and we showed that the overall performance of the system. This paper was published in AAAI this year. I think it's the topmost link on my publications list. And it basically showed that we were able to improve. improve the performance in a quantitative way, improve the performance of the system that was dependent on that ontology by applying, you know, more rigorous methods of ontology engineering. I believe this kind of evidence exists in every engineering discipline.
And you said it was published this year?
Yeah, if you go to my, it was published in the triple... in the AAAI conference this year.
It looks like you and Rucci and Jennifer published it.
Evaluating
right. Ontology cleaning. Okay, great.
Yes.
I'll look for that in the proceedings.
Okay, did that answer your question?
Oh, yes, very good. I appreciate
okay.
that very much.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other questions? Well, maybe just for the records, did anyone join us after we took a roll call earlier? No. Oh, I forgot to mention we should also thank Bill McCarthy for suggesting that we invite Chris over, and also to Evan Wallace, who actually participating in helping locate Chris. And of course, we thank Chris very much for spending time with us, even by calling in from Italy, all the way from Italy. What time is it for you, Chris?
It's about 9:30. And thanks also to the LOA, the Laboratory for Applied Ontology here, for paying for the phone call.
Fantastic. So, any further question for Chris?
I really appreciate your time, Chris. Thank
you. Appreciate it too.
You're welcome.
Excellent.
I hope I made sense.
Right. I hope you stay close and watch what we're doing. Keep us honest. And on behalf of the Ontolog Forum, this is November 18th, year 2004. It's our Dr. Christopher Welty has been our invited speaker of the month. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.